yat atamatropadishtena yogina varurutsasi yat prasadam savai pungsang duraradyo mato mama atā. Therefore, matra, by your mother, upadishtena, want to elevate yourself. I certainly, mata, opinion, mama, my. Translation. Now you have decided to undertake the mystic process of meditation under the instruction of your mother, just to achieve the mercy of the Lord. But in my opinion, such austerities are not possible for an ordinary man. It is very difficult to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Responsibly, please. Now you have decided to undertake the mystic process of meditation under the instruction of your mother, just to achieve the mercy of the Lord. But in my opinion, such austerities are not possible for an ordinary man. It is very difficult to satisfy. Narad Muni, he's saying quite a few different things here. In the beginning, we see that he's actually, you could almost say that he's kind of speaking in a condescending way to Dhruva. Because first off we've seen, he said, you know, you're just a little boy. And then we see the verse after next, he's going to say, go home. So he's being, you could almost say, condescending. And in the same way we see Arjuna, Krishna does the same thing to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. He says to him, you know, you're speaking so-called learned words, but Narad Muni is playing with Dhruva in a similar fashion. He's just saying, you know, you're a little boy, your mother sent you to the forest, why don't you just go home? But he's testing him. He's testing to see his sincerity. And we see Rikit Maharaj, the various hellish planets and the sufferings the living entity go through. He asks Sukadeva Goswami, he says, you know, you've described the situation of the living entity in this material world, and you've described the activities they perform, and the reactions they suffer as a result, and the various hellish planets they go to as a result of their activities. So how can the living entity overcome that situation? And Sukadeva Goswami says, oh, actually, they can overcome this situation by performing atonement. By atoning for their sins, they can overcome. And then Parikit Maharaj, he responds and he says, actually, it's just like, you know, one may perform these sinful activities and perform atonement to overcome the reaction to the sins, but still the seed remains in the heart. It doesn't actually overcome this seed of this sinful desire, this papa bijam. And He compares it to, he said, it's just like the bathing of an elephant. You know, the elephant goes, he says, a kunjara sochara, that the elephant goes into the water, it bathes, and you see in these videos sometimes, you'll see the elephant state of their body. So what's the point of the bathing? They just dirty themselves up again. So he's likening the performance of atonement to the bathing of an elephant, because what happens is one may perform some sinful activity, and then perform some atonement so they don't get reaction, but still the desire remains, and they go and they perform sinful activity again. So they're, you know, committing these sins and then having to suffer reactions. And it's very similar, we see in Christianity. They have this practice of confession. You know, the person may perform some sinful activity, then they go to perform confession to, you know, so-called overcome the reactions. But then next week, they're performing sinful activities again. And then the next weekend, I think it's Saturday, they do it. I've never done it, so I don't really know, but I've heard about it. The next Saturday, they're back and they're doing confession again to try and overcome the reactions to their sins. But this is not actually a sensible thing to do, because really it's just wasting so much time. We're, you know, performing sin, atoning, performing sin, atoning, performing sin, atoning, really not getting anywhere. You know, that just keeps you in the material world. Really what we need to do is to give up the sinful desire. This is the solution. And simply to perform atonement is not the means to give up this sinful desire. The means to give up the material desire is to take to a spiritual practice where the heart actually becomes purified. And we see Lord Chaitanya, he describes this process of chanting. He says, Chaito Dhapana Marjanam, Baba Mahadvagni Nivapanam. That this chait, this is the process. Not necessarily the same, you know, exactly the same activities, but the point is of where we're performing material activities and becoming implicated and entangled in this material world. And Krishna, he makes that work done as a sacrifice of Vishnu must be performed. Otherwise, the work will cause bondage. So unless we're doing some spiritual activity, whatever we're doing in this material world will bring about bondage. So the point that Krishna's making is by doing your activities for Krishna, because he uses the word work, by doing your activities for Krishna, this will bring about liberation, mukta sangha samachara. But if we do it for any other reason, it will bring about bondage in this material world. So this is the conversation also between won't work. We actually need to have a solution, which is spiritual activity. As I was mentioning the other day, there are no material solutions to material problems. It just doesn't work, because all it does is it brings about another problem. It may change the problem you've got, but it transforms it into another problem. And that's you know, material life. As long as you're trying to deal with these problems in a material fashion, it will possibly solve that problem, but another problem will arise. So the only way of dealing with these things is by actually, you know, a spiritual process, a genuine spiritual process, not, you know, the modern concept of the spiritual process. You know, so many things, you know, yoga or this or that or whatever. You know, there's so many things that people are considering to be spiritual processes, but actually, if you carefully analyze them with the application of a bit of intelligence, one will see that actually these are material processes. Why? Because just like we see, you know, so many persons' concept of religiosity is they go to the temple, they go to the church, and they ask the Lord for material benediction. You know, give me wife, give me car, give me this, you know. You know, even we see in Christianity, you know, because he's been upset by his stepmother was telling him to go to meditate upon Krishna. And then his mother's agreeing, yes, this is the best path. And then by the arrangement of Krishna, he meets Narad Muni. Krishna actually sent Narad Muni there to initiate him. So this is why we see here that Narad is testing him out, because he's going to become his disciple. He wants to make sure he's a worthy person. And we see, you know, even within ISKCON, that before the guru initiates a disciple, they test them to see if they're actually qualified. And this may come in so many different ways. You know, and the basic test is, you know, you come, you chant japa for 6 months, you follow the four regular principles, you perform devotional service, and then, you know, then you're observed how you're advancing in the process of bhakti. Are the material desires diminishing? And then one gets first initiation, then after some time of continuing the process of bhakti, you know, and you know, it's not like you just go ahead and there's no assessment, there's no analysis. And even now we find it's getting even more difficult. I remember when I got initiated, there was no test. You just stuck around for a while and you got initiated. You know? And now there's so many tests. You know, there's, you know, to take shelter of guru, there's a test. To get first initiation, there's a test. To get Brahman initiation, there's a test. So many tests. You know, if one wants to be an initiating guru or be a sannyasi, there's so much assessment. You know, it takes 4 or 5 years. You know, if you want to be a sannyasi now. Which it's not a bad thing, because then one can actually assess to see if the person is genuine. And it's not just in ISKCON that these tests are there, because we see that in the spiritual path, Maya is constantly, the material energy, is constantly placing tests before us. You know, One will be, trying to make progress in spiritual life. And there's always so many different allurements that are being presented, the allurement of intoxication, of sex life, of money, whatever it is. Maya's very expert because she knows what's going on for you. She knows what your inner desires are. And she will test those things. If one's weakness is food, for instance, like some people, they really like to eat a lot, then you'll be tested. If one's weakness is the opposite sex, then you'll be tested in that way. So the idea is that we need to have this, as Krishna points out in the Gita, he says, Bahu Shakehantasya Buryo Vyavasayam. It's like, for those whose determination is irresolute, then their focus is many branch. But he says, Eke he kurunandana. But for one who has this one pointed attention in Krishna consciousness, then they'll actually be successful. And we see here, as this story evolves, we'll see how Dhruva, his determination is so focused that he ultimately sees Krishna within a very, very short period of time. We mentioned the other day, it's only 6 months he performs his vow. And he sees the Supreme Personality. There's such determination. And that's what's happening here, is Narad Muni is testing his determination. Is he really interested in this? Or is he just, some child who's got some momentary infatuation, who's just, upset about something, I'm going to get, this and do that. And then, as we know often in our youth and childhood and that, we get really worked up about something, but it goes away within a short period of time. So he's seeing, is this just a childhood infatuation, or is this something that he's really determined about? So that's why Narad Muni is testing him. Rishu Prabhupada's purport. The process of bhakti yoga is simultaneously very difficult and very easy to perform. Sri Narad Muni, the Supreme Spiritual Master, is testing Dhruva Maharaj to see how determined he is to prosecute devotional service. This is the process of accepting a disciple. And of course we see that in ISKCON, because of the nature of the society, like previously what would happen is that a guru would live in the ashram and the disciple would come and live with the guru. But in this day and age, especially in a society like ISKCON, that's not so practical because we have approximately 400 temples in ISKCON. And, there's not that many gurus. There's less than 100. And most of them are traveling. So they, if lucky, they get to see the disciples once or twice a year. So what happens is rather than the disciple testing, then you'll have the local authorities will test, that they'll be evaluating people, observing their application of the process of devotional service. They'll be giving them various, knowledge tests and things like that, just to see how they're applying themselves to the process of bhakti and how they're progressing. Not just that they're applying themselves, but actually, is the process working for them? Because it's not, devotional service is not a static process. You just come, you sit in the temple, you chant japa every day, attend the morning program and follow the regular principles and nothing happens, nothing changes. No, the fact that you're applying, because one can apply externally something, but if there's no internal shift, then nothing will change. There actually needs to be, the process of bhakti means a change of heart. Unless the heart changes, unless the heart's becoming purified, and we're giving up material desires, we're giving up this tendency to want to enjoy the material nature, or lord it over the material nature, it means we're not effectively applying ourselves. And Krishna also addresses this in the Gita. He explains that one who externally applies themselves to devotional service, but internally maintains material desires, is called a pretender. He says, "Michacharas uchite." This person's a pretender. He's only actually cheating. And I can't remember. Maybe it's Bhaktivinoda Thakur also addresses this: how they're just cheating the innocent public. Or maybe it might be Bhaktisiddhantha in this disciple. In the book Vaishnav K. where he talks about how one may perform these various spiritual practices externally just to bewilder the public. Because I've seen it so many times in different places in India, for one example, how someone may present themselves as a yogi or a mystic or a, you know, some kind of meditator or that, and people will just offer them respect without even analyzing the nature of their practice or whether they're actually giving up material desires. And they treat them as a sadhu. But, you know, when they go home, that's kind of like their job. They do the job of being a sadhu, but when they go home, they're drinking tea or smoking bidis or whatever. You know, there's actually no change in heart. They're still attached to enjoying the material nature. So, you know, the disciple needs to be tested to see, are they actually giving up material desires? Are they? And this is one of the prime symptoms, especially in the beginning stages, of seeing whether one's making progress in spiritual life, is, are you giving up material desires? Are we giving up this attachment to enjoying the material energy? Are we giving up this desire to enjoying separate from Krishna? And of course, it's, you know, generally speaking, it's not something that's overnight. It takes time. It takes significant time for us to, you know, give up these desires. But we can see, you know, that the progress is being made. It may be slow progress, and especially if we analyze ourselves day to day, we may not notice things so rapidly. But then if you look back over a period of years, you can see, actually, you know, previously I was attached to this, I was attached to this, I was attached to that, but these things are gone now. You know? And, you know, I'm becoming more and more attached to the process of hearing and chanting. These are indications of what one's actually making spiritual progress. And of course, you know, the experience I've often had is whenever I go to Mayapur and spend a few weeks in Mayapur, after leaving Mayapur, I actually feel I've made tangible spiritual advancement. Mayapur is such an amazing place like that. It's described that even, you know, because like when you go to most dharms, you know, when you pay obeisances to devotees, you pay obeisances to the dharma, you pay obeisances to deities, you get the benefit, you know, a significant benefit from paying obeisances. When you go to Mayapur, when you lie down to sleep at night, this is counted as paying obeisances, yeah? Because you're lying down in the dharma. Every step you take in the dharma is spiritual progress. It's quite an amazing place, especially because Mayapur is called Ordharya Dharma, very, very merciful. Everything you do in Mayapur is very, very beneficial. The great sage Narada has come to Dhruva under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead just to initiate him. This is his purpose. He's come there to give him diksha. But he wants to make sure that, you know, he's not just, you know, whimsically initiating someone who's not serious about the process of bhakti. Because this can create, of course, Narada Muni, he's a great transcendentalist, and Prabhupada here mentions he's the supreme spiritual master. He's, you know, of so many great personalities, Narada's the spiritual master. You know, the Kumaras, Yudhisthira, you know, whether it's Diksha or Siksha, it's not so important, but the point is that he has guided so many persons, Prahlad. You look at practically every great personality in our parampara or in our Shastra has been guided by Narada Muni, either, you know, through Siksha or through Diksha. So he's quite a personality, but still, he's testing Dhruva, because if the Guru takes, you know, unqualified disciples, this has an effect on the Guru. There's reactions involved. Yet he is testing Dhruva's determination to execute the process. It is a fact, however, that for a sincere person, devotional service is very easy. But for one who is not determined and sincere, the process is very difficult. And we also see that with devotees, that they'll progress at different rates in devotional service. And I always wondered about this, and then I read a passage in this, I believe it's the second chapter of the Nectar of Devotion, where Rupa Goswami, he poses the question, and he mentions, he says that what brings one to the process of bhakti, because, how does he phrase it? Let's see if I can remember. Bit blank on it. He just poses this question. He says, you know, what brings one to the process of bhakti? Because he's saying that, you know, that one cannot just, you know, accidentally come to bhakti. And then he points out that it's only through the connection of a pure devotee, you know, through receiving the mercy of a pure devotee, that one can come to the path of bhakti. And then so he explains, after asking the question, he explains that often what happens is like if there's no obvious connection of a pure devotee, yet we see devotees come to the process of devotional service, then they advance quite rapidly in bhakti, but then they start to plateau. And he's explaining that this has come from previous life's practice of bhakti, that one in a previous life has gone to a certain point in the devotional service, and then for whatever reason that they've either left their body or they've stopped performing, you know, practicing bhakti, and they've gone away for some time, but then in their next life they come back. And again, they practice bhakti, and they'll very quickly they'll come to that point, and then they'll steadily make progress from that point on. So you know, one's perfection in bhakti can be something that goes over many, many years. It's not necessarily that one will achieve perfection in one life. And the point that Narada Muni is making here, very difficult to actually get to this point of pleasing the Supreme Personality of God in one life can be very difficult. Of course, if someone's very sincere and able to give themselves easily or completely to the Supreme Lord and to the process of bhakti, then they'll make advancement very rapidly. But it's rare that we find devotees like that, but it does happen. And we see here also another interesting point, at least I find it very interesting, is two verses on, Narada Muni, he says to Dhruva to go home, and when you grow up you can practice bhakti. And we see that also Sukadeva is saying to Parikshit, same kind of thing, is do it later, you know, don't worry about it for now. Prahlad, same thing. But when we meet different people in day to day business, sometimes we come across people and they'll say this, I'll do this when I get older. But you might not get older. You might actually achieve that point. And that's the nature of this material world. You don't know. You know, here we are sitting in the temple room, and we don't know what's going to happen. You know, we could be sitting here on a plane. You know, it's kind of interesting. I was in New York, I was in Seattle when they had this World Trade Tower thing happen, you know, where the planes flew into the World Trade Towers. And then about a week after that, a plane was taking off from, you know, once the plane started flying again, a plane was taking off from one of the airports in New York. There's a few airports there. A plane was taken off from one of the airports, and one of the engines dropped off and came crashing through the roof of a house. No one was in the house at the time, but if you can imagine, if someone was in the house, they would have been killed. And they thought it was a terrorist plot, and you know, everyone was very paranoid about it. But the point being is, in this material world, you just don't know at any given moment what could happen. We could be sitting here in the temple room discussing the Bhagavatam, and an engine could drop through the roof of a plane. And we're all gone. And it's real life. It happens every day. Stuff like this happens every day. You know, like last year, I was telling some devotees about the floods we had in Moolambar last year. And this lady was driving down the road in Tombolgan, which is a town a little bit north of Moolambar. And she hit a patch of mud in the car. She had two or three kids in the car. And the car just slid off the road and went into the river. And only one of the girls got out, or the mother and the children died. And it's just the nature of this material world. You don't, you know, don't say, oh, well, I'll get serious about bhakti when I'm older. Because you might not get older. This might be, you know, as far as we get. Or we might only have a few more years. You just don't know. You know, an astrologer can tell you this thing and that thing, but you just don't know. Because life is full of unexpected twists and turns. And every day, we things are happening we just don't expect. So the point here, and we'll see, this is what Narada Muni indicates to Dhruva later on, and Dhruva's determination. And we see the same with Prahlad Maharaj. He says, no, don't wait. Don't think that it's going to happen later. Now. You know, and there's a really interesting prayer in the Mukunda Mala Stotra by King Kulashekhar, where he prays the Lord. He says, no, I want you to take me right now while I'm meditating on you, because I don't know what's going to happen. At the moment of death, I may not be able to remember you. I may not be able to chant your name. You know, my voice will be choked up with mucus, and I may not be able to speak. You know, and if you ever see, you know, people when they die, I mean, generally speaking, they're panicking. Not so much for devotees. I mean, I've been present with a number of devotees dying, but, you know, generally they're a little bit more, by Krishna's grace, a bit more focused on the Lord. But generally speaking, when people are, you know, caught up in this anxiety of dying and losing everything, they can't think of these things. An interesting story I remember Sri Pallad told me years ago. There was this gentleman that was, you know, he met Narad Muni, and Narad Muni wanted to take him back to Godhead, and he was saying to Narad Muni, he says, oh, look, you know, just give me a few years, you know, I want to get married, I want to have some children, and then you know, I'll be ready to go. And then so Narad Muni says, okay, I'll come back. And so a few years later, he comes back, he's got married, and child has been born, and he says, oh, let's go. And he says, well, you know, the child's born, I want to see it grow up, I want to, you know, get a little bit older, you know, so you know, it's not so much, mother's not so burdened by all the work and stuff like that, looking after the child. And then he says, okay, I'll come back. So he comes back again, and the child's a little bit older, starting to go to school. And he says, oh, the child's just started to go to school. Just let me, you know, get through the education, you know, let the child graduate, you know. And then he goes, it just keeps going on and on and on like this. You know, every time he comes back throughout his whole life, Narad Muni keeps coming back and he keeps giving all these reasons about his attachments. And then finally, when he's an old man, Narad Muni comes and says, all right, let's go. You're an old man now. There's nothing else to live for. Let's go. He goes, oh, just go and tell my wife. And then he goes to tell his wife, and he dies on the way. So he misses out. You know, so the point is, it's like, don't waste time on this. You know, Prabhupada, there's that album that Krishna Prem did, you know, Krishna Vision, and where he did that Krishna Vision rap or whatever it was, and he put in various sort of sound bites from Srila Prabhupada, and one of them was from a lecture Prabhupada gave in Los Angeles. He said, don't waste time. If you have time, chant Hare Krishna. And I remember I saw a news clip the other day. Actually, it was a few months back now, and some famous person had recently left their body, and their last, according to their daughter, their last recorded words was, so much wasted time. And as devotees of Krishna, we want to do our best to make sure that we're not wasting any time, because, you know, the old saying, a moment wasted cannot be bought back for all the gold in the world. So, you know, right from the beginning of our lives, and for us that could mean, you know, the day we walk into the temple. But right from the very beginning of our practice of bhakti, don't waste time. Whatever time you have, apply that in becoming Krishna conscious. If you've got a few minutes to spare, chant Hare Krishna, you know, read, you know, something from the Gita or whatever, you know, just spend your time focusing on Krishna consciousness, because you don't know. As I was saying before, you don't know what could happen. And at any moment, we could leave this body. At any moment. You know, even we see like sometimes, you know, with some of these diseases that are getting around these days, like people might be in the prime of their life, so to speak, and then all of a sudden they're struck down with some kind of affliction and they can't even speak anymore. You know, so don't leave it, you know, like it's being suggested here, that, you know, oh, you know, it's too difficult. Do it later when you get old. You're only young. No, don't waste time on this. Don't leave it till later. Don't leave it to a chance that, you know, oh, I'll do it when I get older, because you don't know if that's going to happen or not. So, you know, I think it's very important points that Narad Muni is making here, and also it's interesting that he says that. In my opinion, such austerities are not possible for an ordinary man. I take that to indicate because he's come there with the purpose of initiating Dhruva, knowing that he's not an ordinary person. So in a different way, he's just saying that you know he's not an ordinary person. So therefore, we can see that that's why he's in the pages of the Bhagavatam, because he's not an ordinary person. Same as Prahlad, same as all these great souls, they're not ordinary persons. And when they take to the practice of bhakti, they actually set a very good example. And the example that's being set here is of a child, taking to the practice of bhakti. How, and Prabhupada makes the point, it's easy. Anyone can do it. And the fact is that everyone should do it. Doesn't matter what your position, what type of body you have, whether you're young or old, male, female. Everyone should take to the practice of bhakti. Doesn't matter where you're from. You don't have to be an Indian person to take from the practice of bhakti. Doesn't matter where you're from in this world. Everyone can and should take to the practice of bhakti, because this is the only way one will actually achieve their understanding of their real identity and overcome the conditioning of this material nature. Okay, I'm finished there. Is there any questions at all?
Yeah. Why is it so very difficult to satisfy
Why is it difficult to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Well, Srila Prabhupada mentions here at the end, the last line of the purport, actually the last two sentences, it said, for a sincere person, devotional service is very easy. But for one who is not determined and sincere, it is very difficult. So the difficulty comes in our focus and determination. If we are more determined to enjoy ourselves in this material world, then it's going to become very difficult for us to achieve that. But if we are willing to just give up our attachments in this material world, and we're willing to just dedicate ourselves and surrender ourselves to the Supreme Lord, then it's not difficult. But the difficulty comes from us. But as I was reading yesterday, Kunti mentions, she says, Vipata Shantuta Shastra, that for those who are, she says, my dear Lord, you're easily approachable, but you're not approachable by those who are material, who are still wanting to enjoy. She says, Tvam Makinchana Gochara, that, it's wrong verse, Janmashara Shutashibi, she mentions, that for persons who are trying to improve themselves in the world in terms of Janma, birth, wealth, beauty, fame, then very difficult to approach Krishna. But for those persons who have given up all intention or desire to enjoy this material world, then Krishna is very easy to approach. But we have to, she uses the phrase, materially exhausted. We have to be freed from all this stuff. We're not interested in this stuff. But because we're reluctant to give up our material attachments or our material desires, then it's difficult. So the onus is on us. We need to give up these things. Then it becomes easier. The more we give it up, the easier it becomes. It's just like, to give you a material example from my own life, as the body ages, things get stiffer and sorer. And I know that if I just do some simple exercises every day, it'll be easier. Yeah? But just overcoming that initial hurdle of dedicating time every day to doing some exercises, it's quite challenging. But as long as I don't do it, I'm still going to experience the stiffness and the soreness of the material body. But if I do it every day, then I'll find that it's easier. Anything we do in material life, just like jumping into a cold pool, it's like you stand on the bank of the pool. And, oh no, it's cold. I'm not going to go, but I want to go for a swim. And look at it. You put your toe in. Oh, it's too cold. But just jump in. And then once you jump in, you acclimatize. It's fine. So spiritual life is the same kind of thing. Don't get all sort of disturbed about it. Mental, oh, but it's this, it's that. No, just do it, and you'll see that it's actually very, very helpful, and eventually we'll give up these desires through the process of bhakti, the practice of bhakti. Yeah. Anything else? Prabhu. Yeah, I feel there's degrees of sincerity. It's not just like a black and white thing. We're all, you know, there's one level. And just like we see here, you know, Dhruva had sincerity. He wanted to see the Supreme Person of the Godhead. He wasn't completely, you know, pure, because he still, you know, his motive for wanting to see the Supreme Lord was that he wanted to get a kingdom greater than his grandfather's. That was his motive. So not completely sincere, but there was a degree of sincerity. He was very determined and sincere. The process of purification helps us to increase sincerity, because sincerity basically means without blemish or without you know, some impurity. So in the beginning stages of bhakti, who is like that? Who is without shortcomings? But through applying ourselves in the process of bhakti, then our sincerity increases. And of course, you know, self-introspection is a very, very useful thing in bhakti. You know, to regularly look at ourselves and analyze our practice. And it's just like, you know, like every time I have an interaction with someone, you know, and present, you know, in my own sort of limited way, try to present Krishna consciousness to them, I like to reflect on it and think, well, how did that go, and how could I more effectively connect them with Krishna? You know, what did I do good, and what could I improve? Because ultimately, you know, our goal as followers of Srila Prabhupada is to connect as many people with Krishna as we can. Because we see that's what he did, just everywhere he went. And it wasn't, you know, like Srila Prabhupada wasn't always just like preaching pure Krishna consciousness to people. He was in so many different ways, he was attracting living entities to Krishna. Just by his character, just by his behavior, he was attracting people. Just by the way he'd interact with people. You know, with children, he would interact in one way. You know, he wouldn't necessarily start telling them, "Well, you know, you're in Maya, this thing, that thing. You know, you have to surrender to Krishna." No, he would just interact with them in a way that was pleasing, so they become attracted to Krishna's pure devotee. So, introspection is really good, because, you know, to look at how you've interacted with people and see, and that's an element of sincerity, because then we're looking at ourselves and seeing. Am I acting in the best possible way for the pleasure of Krishna? But just to blindly go through life and not even, you know, think about, you know, our practice or our character, our nature, you know, how we interact with devotees, is it pleasing to devotees? Because if it's not pleasing to devotees, it's not going to be pleasing to Krishna. These are all elements of sincerity. And I think sincerity manifests itself in many different ways. I don't think it's just like, you know, you come and see a switch and you turn it on. It's not an on-off sort of a thing. At least in my understanding. Mahatma Ji.
If you are serving a bona fide spiritual master, you have taken Gurupada Ashraya and you are doing deity worship, so, and what Prabhu is asking, prerequisite for the sincerity. So somehow, if you want to please Krishna, you have got good knowledge, then what should be difficult? You are chanting the holy name, you are doing deity worship, you are taking Guru Pada Ashraya, one of our spiritual master, and you know that that is the only path. If you are happy serving Krishna and the Guru Maharaj. And if the Guru is pleased, then why should there be difficulty?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Devotional service manifests in so many different ways. And, you know, like for some persons, you know, they do deity worship and you know, they're sincere in their practice there. For some, you know, it's, I mean, there's so many different ways and there's so many different levels, and what's working for one person may not work for another person. Or, you know, some people manage to immerse themselves in studying. Some people, they don't read at all. But it doesn't mean that they're not making progress in the path of bhakti. It really depends on the individual and how they apply themselves. And it's not, you know, it's not a black and white kind of proposition. It's like, this is bhakti, and if you don't do it, like if you don't fit into this box like this, then, you know, you're not a devotee. No, because we see that, you know, so many different persons. Just like, you know, you look in the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra. There was, I can't remember the devotee's name, but there's a devotee there, it may be Murari Gupta, who was a devotee of Ram. And the devotees were trying to convince him, no, you have to become a devotee of Krishna. But he just couldn't relate to it. He tried, but he couldn't relate to that because his heart was completely sold out to Ram. And Lord Chaitanya said, no, but his devotion is perfect. So we see that in the practice, you know, just in the time we've spent in ISKCON or associating with devotees, we can see that the bhakti of devotees manifests in so many different ways, and it's not the same for two people. You know, they won't be doing the same. And it's interesting, it is in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. I never read the whole thing, but I read probably half the first book. I just found the language a bit, you know. I'm not a very, very sort of scholastic sort of person. I found the language a little bit hard to deal with. But anyhow, it makes the point there that every person is unique and individual, and the relationship they have with Krishna is unique and individual, and Krishna has a unique and individual quality for every single person. So the way Krishna interacts with every one of us is different, and it's unique. So also the way we practice bhakti is unique. And there's going to be some similarities, like we chant japa, we follow regular principles, whatever it is, you know. There's going to be similarities, but there's also going to be things that we do that are unique. So, but, you know, the fact that one's endeavoring to please Krishna, the fact that one's not coming here to try and further themselves materially, that's an element of sincerity, that's an indication of sincerity. You just have to, you know, and you know, like, it's easy to say, oh, so-and-so is sincere, but then do we really know what's going on in someone's heart? My sort of approach to it is like, we need to look at ourselves and see what's going on for us and analyze, you know. I think daily is good. And in Sri Vaishnavism, they define Panchanga Bhakti, I'm not necessarily saying we should follow this, but it's just something interesting, you know, that you have, what is it, Abhigamana, Upadan, Yoga, Ijas, Sadhyaya. They put a little bit of different order. In Gaudiya Vaishnavism, yoga is defined as like meditation upon the Lord, but in Sri Vaishnavism, yoga, they look at that as introspection. So at the end of the day, one reflects upon the day's activities and you know, how have I done? You know, when I interacted with this devotee, what was that like? When I was serving the deity like this, what was that like? You know, so it's very good to do that, is to look at, you know, daily what we're doing and do we feel we're making progress? Because by looking at these things and reflecting back, you can think, okay, well, I could do this better. Next time I'm going to try and do this better. Next time, you know, when I serve the devotees, I'm going to try and do it, you know, so they're more satisfied or whatever, you know. Just like look at the things you're doing and try to improve. Yeah? Jared? A little bit louder. I struggle to hear you, unfortunately. My hearing's not the best.
Attention to personal responsibility.
personal practice is asking, do I cause that? Am I influencing that? Is it okay to go up to someone and say, look, I understand that you're trying to help, but you're wearing leather. It's okay to help, but you're wearing leather. I say, doesn't matter. And I think to myself, well, if I did that, in the back of my mind would be, I'm creating a demand for leather. I'm creating a demand and an acceptance and killing for leather. When I just need to, if I need a material, there's all these other materials that I could utilize.
Yeah.
And in the back of my mind is a part saying, look, leave it alone. Krishna's got this all. Don't leave it alone. God's got this all. Or whatever.
Yeah.
But then I think, well, if I don't say something, maybe I'm just deceiving myself. Maybe I'm allowing Maya or someone else or something else to go, no, it's not your responsibility, leave him alone. These things can cause a little bit of conflict, and sometimes the answer and the solution seems quite obvious. And I think to myself, well, maybe devotional service seems difficult because I haven't got it right yet, because I'm a problem, because I'm not perfect yet, because I'm not doing something, like I'm not alleviating the gas industry by taking a cold shower, or I'm not alleviating the metal industry by giving up shaving, or something like that. I'm not offering people enough rest. I think about these things.
Yeah.
And I hear other gurus telling me to do the same, but then they're wearing leather, and I don't want to be disrespectful. And I also want to be respectful to cows and to God. And I'm having trouble reconciling.
Yeah. Wait, I think it's a matter of personal responsibility. Huh? Summarize. Okay, I'll do my best. Jared was talking about responsibility and also along the lines of, you know, when he sees others sort of doing things that may be against the principles of bhakti or, you know, committing violence to other living entities such as, you know, wearing leather and stuff like that. And how to take responsibility and how far does that responsibility go? Should I, you know, try and convince them not to wear leather, or should I just keep to myself? Is that essentially what you said? Yeah. So from my perspective on that, it's like I can't change anyone. Actually, I can change one person, me. That's all I can change. And then by my personal example, others may be inspired by that. They may not. I don't feel there's any problem with saying to someone, oh, actually, you know, it's better if you don't wear leather because it's harmful. You know, it's killing cows. Or, you know, actually, I think leather mostly comes from horses. But you know, you're killing other living entities by wearing leather and stuff like that. So, you know, if you want to be a more wholesome and making less impact in this world, then better you don't eat leather. Better you don't support these various industries, you know, that are causing so much harm to the planet and harm to other living entities. It's okay to say something like that, and, you know, especially if a person's open. But the way I look at it is just say it and just let go of it. Then they've got the information. Then it's up to them to make a decision to take personal responsibility. Because we can't change people if they don't want to be changed. But we can change ourselves. So, you know, take personal responsibility for these things means ourselves we don't wear leather, ourselves we don't eat meat, ourselves we don't engage in simple activities or take intoxication or whatever. And if others see our actions and they're inspired by that, then this is going to be the best teacher for them, is, you know, they're inspired by our... There's a Vedic aphorism Prabhupada will sometimes quote, and say, I think it's Bengali. Apani achari prabhu jivera sikaya. First your behavior should become ideal, then you can preach. So once we have ideal behavior, if we say something... I'll give you an example, really good example from my life, at least I think is a good example. My mother was always telling us, don't do drugs. But every night she was getting drunk. It was kind of empty words. You know, because we saw her and she was smoking cigarettes, drinking alcohol, and then telling us not to do drugs. You know. Or another example is like Prabhupada told this story. One time this lady, her child was eating a lot of sweets, and she was trying to stop her child from eating sweets. And whatever she said, the child wouldn't do it, wouldn't listen. So she thought, okay, I'm going to take the child to Mahatma Gandhi, and I asked Mahatma Gandhi to tell this child, my child, not to eat sweets. So Mahatma Gandhi, she went to Mahatma Gandhi, she said, Gandhiji, please, you tell him, he'll listen to you because you're a sadhu. You please tell him, don't eat sweets. And she said, okay, you come back next week. And so she went away, came back next week. And Mahatma Gandhi said to the child, he said, don't eat sweets, they're bad for you. And then she asked him, well, but why didn't you tell him that last week? It was such an easy thing to say. He said, because last week I was eating sweets. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a matter of personal responsibility and integrity. You know, if we live our life, if we live, you know, practice what we preach, then that's going to be very, very effective. But if we're just saying one thing and doing another thing, that's just empty words. And most people see through it pretty quickly. You know, so I think, you know, integrity is a very important thing. Is we have to be the person we're trying to convince others to be. Not that we're sort of, you know, preaching this high, high philosophy which we don't follow ourselves, because no one's going to listen. If we just endeavor with sincerity and with integrity and keep at it, then Krishna will, you know, and like, we don't necessarily get what we expect we're going to get. You know, we could get more, we could get less, we just don't know. But if we keep endeavoring with sincerity and with integrity, then eventually we'll achieve the goal. And that's important. It's like, whatever happens, don't give up, keep going forward. Because if you give up, you'll never get there. You just keep going forward. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki. Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki. Jayantai Gopremanandi.